Picture a hurricane-ravaged Florida town in 2004. You desperately need ice to preserve food and medicine. The price? $10 for what cost $2 yesterday. Your blood boils. This feels wrong. But why? Is it simply supply and demand at work, or something deeper? This tension between what's legal and what's just sits at the heart of how we organize society. When Pentagon officials denied Purple Hearts to veterans with PTSD, or when bailed-out executives blamed their failures on a financial tsunami while pocketing bonuses, they revealed something crucial. Our disagreements about fairness aren't random. They stem from three competing visions of justice: maximizing happiness, protecting freedom, and cultivating virtue. Each sounds reasonable in theory, yet they often clash spectacularly in practice. Consider the trolley problem. Most would divert a runaway train to kill one person instead of five, yet refuse to push someone off a bridge to achieve the same result. This inconsistency isn't irrationality. It's competing moral intuitions wrestling for dominance. Real stakes make these dilemmas even more wrenching. In 2005, Navy SEALs in Afghanistan faced an impossible choice: kill unarmed goat herds who stumbled upon their position, or release them and risk discovery. They chose mercy. 90 minutes later, Taliban fighters surrounded them, killing 19 Americans. Was this moral courage or catastrophic failure? Justice isn't abstract philosophy. It's the agonizing space between principles and consequences, where our deepest values collide with brutal reality. In 1884, four English sailors adrift for 19 days faced starvation. Captain Dudley killed the weakest cabin boy, Richard Parker, so the others could survive on his flesh. When rescued, Dudley defended himself. Killing one to save three maximized lives saved. This cold calculus embodies utilitarianism, the philosophy judging everything by outcomes alone. Jeremy Bentham, its founder, dismissed natural rights as nonsense upon stilts and proposed something elegantly simple: maximize pleasure, minimize pain. The appeal is obvious. Who opposes happiness? Yet utilitarianism stumbles over fatal flaws. First, it tramples individual rights when convenient. Romans throwing Christians to lions might be justified if the crowd's pleasure outweighed victims' suffering. Second, it reduces all values to a single metric. Philip Morris calculated that Czech smokers dying early saved the government $147 million in healthcare costs, a positive effect of cigarettes. Ford determined that fixing the deadly Pinto fuel tank cost more than preventing 180 deaths, valued at $200,000 per life. These aren't thought experiments. They're actual corporate calculations revealing the moral bankruptcy of pure cost-benefit analysis. America's richest 1% control more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. Utilitarians might favor redistribution. Taking from billionaires to help hundreds of families maximizes overall happiness. Libertarians reject this entirely, envisioning a minimal state that enforces contracts and protects property, but never redistributes wealth. Their reasoning: we own ourselves completely, making taxation for redistribution tantamount to theft. Robert Nozick illustrated this with Michael Jordan. Start with any fair wealth distribution. When fans voluntarily pay to watch Jordan play, making him millions, new inequality emerges through purely voluntary exchanges. Who's been wronged? The logic seems airtight. If we own ourselves, we own our labor and whatever we earn. Yet this principle leads to troubling places. If you truly own your body, shouldn't you be free to sell a kidney or yourself into slavery? The case of Armin Meiwes, who killed and ate a willing victim in Germany, represents the ultimate test. For strict libertarians, banning such acts between consenting adults would be as unjust as progressive taxation. Critics note that Jordan's success depends on teammates, coaches, and a society that values basketball. More fundamentally, he didn't earn his height or talent. He was born with gifts that happened to be valuable. If he can't claim moral credit for these natural endowments, does he truly deserve all the wealth they generate? During the Civil War, wealthy Americans could avoid the draft by paying $300 or hiring substitutes, prompting the bitter slogan, "Rich man's war and poor man's fight." This system sparked violent protests and seems obviously unjust today. Yet, how different is our volunteer military, where taxpayers collectively pay others to fight? Two objections challenge this arrangement. First, the free market isn't truly free when economic desperation drives enlistment. Today's military draws disproportionately from low to middle income neighborhoods, while the wealthiest 20% are underrepresented, suggesting economic conscription rather than genuine choice. Second, military service isn't just another job, it's a civic obligation we should share. The Baby M surrogacy case reveals similar limits. When Mary Beth Whitehead couldn't surrender the baby she'd contracted to bear, New Jersey's Supreme Court declared commercial surrogacy amounts to baby selling, violating fundamental values regardless of consent. Today, Indian women earn $4,500 to $7,500 as surrogates, often 15 years' wages. Is this exploitative or empowering? The question reveals that not all voluntary exchanges are just, and not everything should be for sale. If utilitarianism's sacrifice of individuals troubles you, where do rights originate? Immanuel Kant offers a radical answer. Human dignity stems from our capacity for reason and autonomy. True freedom isn't pursuing desires unobstructed. That makes us slaves to appetites we didn't choose. Genuine freedom means acting according to laws we give ourselves through reason. This capacity demands we treat persons as ends in themselves, never merely as means. This explains why pushing someone onto trolley tracks is wrong, even if it saves five lives. It uses that person as an instrument. John Rawls builds on this through a thought experiment. Imagine choosing principles to govern society from behind a veil of ignorance, where you don't know your place, your class, gender, race, talents, or social position. Rational people would reject utilitarianism, which might sacrifice minorities, and pure libertarianism, which could leave them destitute. Instead, they'd choose equal basic liberties and permit only inequalities that benefit the least advantaged, the difference principle. Rawls reaches a surprising conclusion. Distributive justice isn't about rewarding moral desert, since even effort may result from favorable circumstances beyond our control. When Callie Smart, a wheelchair-bound cheerleader with cerebral palsy, was removed from her squad for not performing gymnastics, the controversy centered on cheerleading's true purpose, gymnastics or inspiring school spirit. This exemplifies Aristotle's approach to justice. Determining rights requires understanding a practice's purpose and which virtues it should honor. Unlike modern theories separating fairness from virtue, Aristotle believes justice means giving people what they deserve based on relevant merits. Tennis courts go to skilled players because they best realize the court's purpose. A Stradivarius belongs with a virtuoso, not a collector's display case. The affirmative action debate follows similar logic. Who deserves admission depends on a university's purpose, purely scholarly excellence, or also developing leaders for a diverse society. For Aristotle, distributive justice concerns offices and honors, not primarily wealth. While modern views see politics as procedural and neutral, Aristotle believes politics has a substantive purpose, forming good citizens and cultivating virtue. Participating in politics fulfills our nature as language-using beings who can discern justice and deliberate about the good. Moral virtue requires both habit and practical wisdom. Doing the right thing, to the right person, to the right extent, at the right time, with the right motive, and in the right way. Should nations apologize for historic injustices like the Holocaust or slavery? Moral individualism argues we're responsible only for our own actions, creating a paradox. Conservatives who reject collective apologies on individualist grounds undermine patriotic pride. You can't celebrate your country's achievements while refusing accountability for its failures. Both require acknowledging unchosen ties that shape our identity. Alastair MacIntyre offers an alternative. Humans are storytelling creatures living narrative quests. I can only answer the question, what am I to do, if I can answer the prior question of what story or stories do I find myself a part? These narratives create obligations of solidarity, a third category beyond natural duties and voluntary obligations. Children don't choose their parents, yet still have special responsibilities to them. A politics of the common good would rebuild civic infrastructure, public schools, transportation, health clinics, parks, attractive enough that both rich and poor would use them. Robert F. Kennedy exemplified this in 1968, critiquing Americans' poverty of satisfaction and obsession with the mere accumulation of things. Justice isn't about finding neutral ground. It's about reasoning together toward the common good, acknowledging that how we value things matters as much as how we distribute them.